This is the RTE News at 1 with Brian Dobson. Good afternoon. The headlines this Monday lunchtime. Jonathan Hill is to leave his role as chief executive of the Football Association of Ireland. Gardaí are continuing to question a man in connection with the murder of a 36-year-old man in County Kildare. And a court has heard telecoms company Air employed a deliberate policy aimed at preventing customers from logging complaints. The news in detail now with Brian Jennings.
The Football Association of Ireland has announced that Chief Executive Officer Jonathan Hill is to leave the FAI at the end of the month. Mr. Hill has been in charge of the football body since November 2020. Our soccer correspondent, Tony O'Donoghue.
Jonathan Hill took over the top job in Irish football administration in 2020, following a turbulent time for the association when the government was forced to bail out the FAI after a governance and financial crisis. He took over during the COVID crisis and oversaw Ireland's successful bid to go host the 2028 European Championships, along with England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. He led the growth of the women's game here, helping to negotiate an equal pay agreement for members of the senior international squads, culminating in Ireland's first appearance at a Women's World Cup. Hill was heavily criticised by members of the Public Accounts Committee in Leinster House in February for his explanation of a payment of €11,550 he received from the association in lieu of holidays not taken, which was against the FAI's own staff rulebook. He repaid the money and another €8,000 benefit in kind he received for commuting expenses after an audit found his salary had breached the limit of a general secretary as agreed under the terms of the agreement in 2020. Hill apologised and claimed that it was an unintentional breach. He leaves the FAI at the end of the month and an interim CEO will be announced shortly, followed by a search for a full-time successor.
Gardaí are continuing to question a man in connection with the murder of a 36-year-old man in County Kildare. The body of Shane Knott was discovered in the garden of a house in Naas yesterday afternoon. Our crime correspondent Paul Reynolds.
Gardaí forensic specialists today examined the murder scene and searched for evidence in the surrounding area of the Eustace estate in Naas. The body of Shane Knott was discovered here in the garden of a house at around 1:30 yesterday afternoon. The 36-year-old was the victim of a violent attack and sustained serious head injuries. He may have been attacked with an implement, and Gardaí searched bins and around the area for a possible murder weapon. A man in his 40s was arrested on suspicion of murder and is being detained at a Gardaí station in Kildare. He availed of arrest period overnight, during which his detention period was suspended. He can be questioned for up to 24 hours. Shane Knott had recently been reported missing. Gardaí are following a definite line of inquiry and are not looking for anyone else at present in connection with the murder. Paul Reynolds, RTE News, Naas, County Kildare.
A court has heard telecoms company Air employed a deliberate policy aimed at preventing customers from logging complaints. Air was today fined €7,500 after pleading guilty to 12 counts of breaching regulations governing how complaints should be handled by providers. Our courts reporter, Vivian Trainer.
Telecoms regulator Comreg investigated Air after receiving a number of complaints from customers who said they were unable to lodge or pursue complaints with the company. Michelle O'Donnell from Comreg's compliance section said it was discovered that Air had a training manual for staff telling them not to process complaints in the proper way unless a customer used certain trigger words or phrases which might indicate they were aware of their rights and the regulations. If they mentioned Comreg or said they wanted to lodge an official complaint, they would be passed on to the complaints line. If not, they'd be offered a callback, which often did not happen. Judge Anthony Halpin said it was a serious case and said it was a disgrace that Air had threatened staff with disciplinary action if they did not stick to the policy. He said he could not believe staff had been threatened for complying with Irish law. Lawyers for Air said the company was pleading guilty and apologised to customers, the court and Comreg. They said since these issues came to light in January last year, significant improvements had been made in the complaints handling process, and this year it had received its lowest level yet from Comreg. Judge Halpin imposed fines on 10 counts of breaching regulations, totalling €7,500. Vivian Trainer, RTE News at Dublin District Court.
The Minister for Transport has said that new traffic light cameras will be introduced later this year or early next year as part of efforts to improve road safety. Eamon Ryan was speaking at a major European transport conference which is taking place in Dublin this week. Our work and technology correspondent, Brian O'Donovan.
More than 4,000 people will attend the Transport Research Arena here at Dublin's RDS this week. It's Europe's largest transport and mobility research event. The latest cutting-edge technology in the sector is on display, much of it focused on improving road safety. An EU road safety conference will take place here tomorrow. The Department of Transport is co-hosting this week's event, and speaking at the official opening this morning, Minister for Transport Eamon Ryan said it is essential to reduce the number of deaths on Irish roads. He said that new traffic light cameras are expected to be introduced later this year or early next year with an automated system for capturing offences and issuing fines. Brian O'Donovan, RTE News, at the Transport Research Arena in Dublin.
And now the weather.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Grant. Create a modern, minimalistic home decor look and warmth in every room with Grant Uflex underfloor heating. Visit grant.ie.
Cool and windy today with sunny spells and scattered showers, some heavy and thundery with the chance of hail. Showers will become more confined to the northern half of the country this evening. Highest temperatures 7 to 10 degrees in fresh to strong and gusty northwest winds. And there's a warning that west to northwest winds will reach gale force 8 at times on Irish coastal waters from Loophead to Malin Head to Wicklow Head and on the Irish Sea today and early tonight. Brian.
Thank you, Brian. Still to come this lunchtime, Israel urged to show restraint after that weekend missile attack by Iran. As Thornish and Micheál Martin says, rising tensions are of huge concern. The top Iranian diplomat to Ireland on the risk of further escalation. No manager and now the chief executive departs. Crisis at the Football Association of Ireland. Minister for Health Stephen Donnelly on two new reports into cost savings and productivity in the health service. And how an exodus of landlords and rising rents is leaving parts of the country without a single HAP tenancy. We hear from Sligo.
Whether it's one of your everyday journeys or something a little more epic, the new Volkswagen Tiguan makes every day and every journey extraordinary. The new Tiguan, for all life's journeys. Start your journey today by visiting your local Volkswagen retailer. Volkswagen. The Mother and Baby Institution's payment scheme is now open for applications. This scheme provides financial payments and health supports to eligible people who spend time in mother and baby and county home institutions in Ireland. There's a straightforward application process in place to help everyone access the benefits that they are entitled to. To find out more, visit gov.ie/payment scheme or call the helpline at 01522992, an initiative of the Government of Ireland.
Hello again. You're listening to the news at 1. World leaders are calling on Israel to show restraint over Iran's weekend missile and drone attack. Almost all of the 300 missiles and drones launched on Saturday were intercepted. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's war cabinet, which is empowered to decide on the country's response, is expected to meet this afternoon. Israeli government spokesman David Mensah said his country had the right to defend itself.
We are at the very essence not a war-seeking nation. You know, on Saturday night, Israelis spent a night, mums, dads, kids, in and out of bomb shelters in our country. Israel must be able to defend itself, and it will, both defensively and offensively. Israel, whose first objective is to protect its own citizens, we will be defended.
Speaking in Cork, the Thornishan Minister for Foreign Affairs, Micheál Martin, said every effort needed to be made to de-escalate tensions.
This is of huge concern to the entire world. It's of particular concern to the people of the region who have suffered far too much. We have too much war in the world, and every effort has to be made to de-escalate the situation in the Middle East, and particularly in respect of the hostilities between Iran and Israel. We acknowledge that, and there's no question but that Iran has been a malign actor and has been a shadow war of a form through the various proxies, be it Hamas, Hezbollah, or the Houthis. But this was the first full-on country attack on another country, albeit the nature of it is such that the defences were able to deal with it, and quite a number of countries came to the aid of Israel to defend against the missiles and against the drones. And what is required now is a de-escalation of this particular aspect of it. We need an end to the war in Gaza.
Tánaiste Micheál Martin speaking in Cork this morning. Well, a short while ago, we spoke to Iran's top diplomat to this country, Dr. Kazim Sharif Kazimi, chargé d'affaires at the Iranian embassy in Dublin. I began by asking him why Iran had carried out the weekend attack.
Iran gave 12 days to international community, UN Security Council, to make decisions and condemn Israeli attack Iranian embassy in the Damascus. But unfortunately, this decision has been blocked by the UK, USA and France, and nothing happens in the UN Council. And Iran, for deterrence and especially for the peace and security, took these very limited military exercises on the military objectives. And
I don't know how you can describe 170 drones, 30 cruise missiles and 120 ballistic missiles as limited.
Yeah, it is limited. Why I said limited? It is Iran predict part of that these attacks will be shut down by the USA and a few other countries which cooperate and allied with the Israelis. Mm-hmm. So because of that, Iranians military predict that and use the minimum attacks that it's possible. Because the military bases which used by the Israel attack Iranian embassy, just these bases has been targeted.
You say the targets were military bases, but the likelihood is if any of these missiles had got through, they would have risked substantial civilian casualties.
It's a good question, but who is the responsible that? Even within this...
Who fired the missiles?
Who attacks to the Iranian embassy? Before these 6 months, during 6 months, many Iranian person has been killed in the Syria, in the many places by the Israeli. Because of the tension, because of the sensitive situation in the region, Iran took a restraint and be patient within 6 months. But this time, Iranian's diplomatic mission has been violated and targeted, and some diplomatic holder person has been killed. And unfortunately, UN Council couldn't make a decision because of the USA and the UK.
Where is the Iranian restraint when Iran has backed Hamas? Your own president has recently hailed the October 7th attacks as something that will bring about the end of the Zionist regime, as he described it. Iran continues to back Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. As we know, on a daily basis, there are missiles being fired at northern Israel.
Based off the Irish history, I think Irish people know about the resistance group. They are not, for example, some things in the vacuum situation has been come up. They are a resistance group. Why? Because of the occupied land. If really you wanted to know the real fact, refer to your own delegation visited the occupied land in September 23. In that report, it mentioned 2,500 Palestinian people within a few months has been killed because of this occupied land.
Are you saying that justifies the October 7th attacks?
It's not justifying October 7th because the most problem of some media is just focusing on the one day. The real problem is the occupied land and the situations happening in this region by the Israeli regime's apartheid regime.
Is Iran braced for further retaliatory action by Israel?
Iran sent after the military action completely make it clear, even before that, if Iran didn't want to give a surprise attack. Before the attack, a few days before, Iran informed USA and a few countries, and Iran will, because of the no action in the Security Council, Iran will take actions of that. And after that, we make it clear our military action has been finished, and it is the limited military action. If something's happened new, Iran will be do it where it's right away. Iran won't wait 10 days and for that.
The chargé d'affaires at the Iranian embassy, Dr. Kazim Sharif Kazimi. Well, let's talk now to Lindsay Hilsum, Channel 4 News International Editor. She's on the line. Lindsay, thanks indeed for taking our call this lunchtime. So we heard the Iranian government representative there describing this as a limited missile attack. That's not how the Israelis see it.
No, obviously it was limited in the sense that the Israelis with their allies, including the British and the Americans, were able to shoot down all the missiles which came in. And Iran must have known that that is what would happen. In that sense, it was symbolic. But it was an Iranian attack on Israeli soil. It was a direct attack, and that has not happened before. So obviously, from the Israeli point of view, that's a provocation, and they have said that they will need to retaliate. And you know, the Israelis have been wanting to have a go at Iran, as it were, for a long time. And arguably, this gives them the excuse to do so.
There's been low-level conflict between the two states for some considerable time. Lindsay, this is the first time I think Iran has launched a direct attack on Israeli territory. If it's likely to produce some kind of Israeli response, what's the risk of this escalating further?
Well, there is a great risk of that. It really depends what Israel decides to do. The Americans are trying to persuade Israel not to retaliate and to say that the fact that they shot down the missiles is in itself a victory. I think that's unlikely to wash with Benjamin Netanyahu. They could do something which is not so easily detectable, like a major cyber attack. They could blow up facilities, military facilities or nuclear facilities within Iran, using the assets that they already have there. Iran is very penetrated by Israeli spies. Or they could send in drones and, F-35s and jet planes to actually bomb Iran, which would obviously be the maximalist approach. Mm-hmm. So those are the basic options that they have, and as yet we don't know which they're going to go for.
Aside from those military consequences, is there any sense in which this has begun to backfire in Iran? It's obviously taken the focus of the moment off Gaza. It's generated international support for Israel at a time when it was increasingly isolated, and it seems to have brought Washington and Tel Aviv closer together.
Yes, arguably you could say that, but I think, you know, the Iranians would look on this differently, because although they have grown used over the years to this, to a lower key war, a war through proxies, which has involved their proxies in what they call the axis of resistance, Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Houthis in Yemen, and others trying to, attacking Israel in various ways. Israel has constantly been, although it never admits it, assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists, sabotaging Iranian facilities, and taking out senior members of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. And by doing that on the 1st of April, when 7 Revolutionary Guard commanders were killed in an attack on the Iranian mm-hmm. consulate in Damascus. From the Iranian point of view, that was overstepping a line, and that was why they felt that they had to respond directly by attacking Israel itself. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is a situation where anybody can overplay their hand. Either side can overplay their hand. Either side can make a mistake. And then the whole region is in flames.
Lindsay Hilsum, Channel 4 News. Thanks very much indeed for that. Here at home, Jonathan Hill, the chief executive of the Football Association of Ireland, will leave his post at the end of the month. He's been in charge of the football body since November 2020. An interim CEO will be appointed by the FAI, which will be followed by, quote, a structured search for a full-time successor, according to a statement issued this morning. Let's talk to our soccer correspondent, Tony O'Donoghue, who's with us here in the studio. Tony, I suppose this was coming.
It probably was, because there was an appearance before the Public Accounts Committee in February, and Mr. Hill's performance was derided by many politicians and a number of people within the organisation as well, because some saw it as a disaster indeed. He was there to answer questions about the reason why the association had their funding suspended temporarily, and that was because his salary exceeded that of a General Secretary of the Department, which is one of the conditions of the Memorandum of Understanding, which was basically what bailed out the FAI during their governance and financial crisis. It was a small amount of money. It was 12,500. It was paid back, excuse me, but it was against the house rules, the staff rules of the FAI, and there was another 8,000 in commuting expenses. And when the new president of the FAI, Paul Cook, was asked, he couldn't express confidence in his own CEO. He said his confidence was challenged, and I think at a difficult time for football in this country, that was a very significant step.
So no manager, as we know, and later this year there'll be no chief executive officer, but the search for his replacement will get underway.
Well, to Mr. Hill's credit, there was a lot good during his 3.5 years when you consider, for example, the fact that we have managed to gain the rights for hosting of the Euro 2028 along with England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. He helped negotiate an equal pay deal for the women footballers with their male counterparts, landed that Sky deal finally for the men to get a sponsor after a wait of almost 4 years. And that was significant. But I think public opinion, in a sense, the wait for this new men's manager has gone on for 145 days now since Stephen Kenny left his post, and it has left people wondering who's in charge, who's running the organisation. Mr. Hill was part of the delegation, including Mark Canham and Paddy Bonner, that were set the task of appointing a new manager. We're hopeful that it'll be this week, but it has been a long time coming. And any sports organisation, particularly the FAI and their recent traumatic history, you need an important, significant, strong figure at the top.
And finding someone to replace Jonathan Hill, given what's been going on in recent times within the association, all the various issues that that it faces, how difficult is that going to be to find a high-calibre candidate? It's a fairly small pool, I would have thought.
Well, if they take as long over finding a CEO as they are over finding a manager. The independent chair of the board, Tony Cahan, thanked Mr. Hill and said he had guided the association through an incredibly difficult period and led the transformation of the association and leaves them with a robust organisational structure and a vastly improved financial position. It might be seen to, by them to be robust, but there's nobody at the top.
Thank you. Soccer correspondent Tony Donoghue, thanks very much for that. A plan to deliver more than €500 million in savings in the health service next year has been published today after a government report suggested that hospital activity has not kept pace with increases in staffing and resources in recent years. A Department of Health HSE action plan targets non-pay savings this year of approximately €224 million, rising to €554 million in a full year. They include on medicines, procurement, the cost of long-term residential care for older people and management consultancy. A separate report also released today identifies a significant divergence between the expenditure and the workforce provided relative to the growth in activity in the health service. So for more on this, we're joined in studio by the Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly. Very good afternoon to you, Minister, and welcome to the programme. Perhaps I could come first to this productivity report. You commissioned it because you began to have questions yourself about what was happening to the additional investment in the health service in recent years. And this covers the period, I think, 2016 to 2022. So partly covered by the COVID pandemic. What does it tell you?
What it tells us is what we're seeing in Ireland, Brian, is a reduction in productivity that they're seeing in the UK, they're seeing in various countries around Europe. There's a lot of progress being made. There's been huge investment. There's been a lot of reform. Our healthcare workers are doing an excellent job in driving down the waiting list, driving down the number of patients on trolleys, and rolling out new services. We're seeing now in more and more areas, for example, people who previously would have waited years for healthcare, be it cataracts in Dublin or gynaecology in Sligo or other areas, people who were waiting years are now waiting months. So the investment is working. But one of the things we have to do to set the health service up for years to come is increase productivity. Let me give you a quick example. One of the areas we've looked at is the amount of outpatient appointments being done per consultant. Now, our consultants are working just as hard as they ever have, but they're getting less time to spend on outpatients. And so what we're seeing over a period of time from 2016 onwards is they're seeing less patients in a given year than they used to. Now, that's not their fault. I'm talking to clinical leads about it. I'm talking to hospital teams about it. What the doctors are saying to me is, yes, the number of doctors has gone up, but we need to see the supports increase. We need to see clinical rooms available. We need to see theatres available. Some of them have said that infection prevention and control brought in through COVID reduced the number that they could see. But they're saying themselves, look, it's time now to meet up as the clinical leadership in our health service and increase the amount of care being provided. So it's a combination.
Are you saying that the additional resources, extra staff, extra money that's gone into the health service should be producing more activity? There should be greater productivity?
I'm saying two things. I'm saying the extra resources that are going in is increasing the amount of patients being seen.
But not commensurate to the amount of additional resources.
Not commensurate to the amount of additional resources. And that really is the focus, to say we have invested, we'll keep investing. For example, we're going from about 3,000 hospital consultants up to 6,000 hospital consultants. But if we're to achieve our goal, which is every patient can get the care they need when they need it, we need, as well as investing and growing the service, we need to get as much as we can from the resources that we have.
But there could, again, according to the report, be lots of reasons for this productivity gap, if you like, or productivity puzzle, I think is the phrase that's used in the report. It could be the impact of COVID is identified. It could be the effect of Ukrainian refugees coming here and the complexities that adds to the delivery of treatment. It could be demographic changes. It could be birth rates falling in some hospitals, which means less activities in those hospitals as a result of that. So this is a very complex picture, isn't it?
It is, and that's exactly why we've spent a lot of time looking at the numbers, looking at what's driving this, talking to the doctors, talking to the clinical leaders. I put in place a productivity and savings task force then at the start of this year. This is not an easy thing to unpick. But what the doctors are saying to me really comes down to two things. They're saying you need to keep investing. The government needs to keep investing, that they need more staff, they need more theatres, they need more clinical rooms, and they're right. What they're also saying to me is they can probably do a bit of a check-in themselves, do a bit of a refresh themselves. I'll give you one simple example. Yeah, there was one clinical lead. He said, look, in any given day, he said, our team pre-COVID probably saw 50 patients a day. And he said, when COVID happened, because of the COVID, we had to go down to about 30 a day.
Okay.
And he said, there's really no reason why we haven't gone back up to 50. And we now really need to get together and do that. So it's a combination
of things. You've been in this job 4 years. We're within sight of the finish line of this government. And now you're saying that there are issues in relation to productivity in the health service. Now you're coming forward with a report to say we need to tackle this. Now you're coming forward with a cost-saving plan.
Oh, well, not at all. We've been working on this from day one. So if we're going to have a legitimate conversation on productivity, we have to invest first. There's no point engaging with doctors who are saying to us, we don't have enough beds, we don't have enough nursing staff, we don't have enough hospital consultants. There's no point engaging with them and saying, we just need you to do more. That's not a reasonable conversation to have. We needed to show that the government was serious about achieving universal healthcare, everyone being able to get the care they need when they need. Now, the other thing we had to do over the last few years is we had to build productivity into the service. The new public-only consultant contract, we launched it a year ago. Now half the consultants are on it. Advanced practice in nursing. These are the things we've been putting in place over the last few years.
We know, Minister, that you were looking for an extra $1.3 billion in this year's budget for the HSE. And you're coming today with savings, you say, that could be something of the order of $440 million. Now, where's that going to come from this year?
It's going to come from different places. One of the things we're doing is reducing the dependency on overtime and on agency. We spend far too much on agency. So what I want to do is increase our permanent workforce, roll out safe staffing in all our hospitals, in all our wards, keep going towards our target of 6,000 hospital consultants, and reduce the reliance on overtime, reduce the reliance on agency. We're going to reduce the medicines budget. Now, clearly, to be clear for your listeners, we're increasing the spend on new medicines by 30 million euro, but we believe that we can get better deals, better prices through negotiation. We're looking at better procurement practices within the hospitals. We're looking at the HSC-run nursing homes, because as the private providers have said many times, they've said, look, there's a big discrepancy between the costs per nursing home.
They say they're underfunded.
They do. And so what we're doing is we're looking at exactly what the drivers of the higher costs in the HSC facilities are and saying, are there things we can learn? Are there different ways of working?
You're going to save money on those HSE-run care homes, is that right?
We're looking at it. So we're looking at all of the drivers of these.
Is that figure in the 440 million? Is there a saving from the nursing home sector?
It's one of the measures in the.
So you do intend to save money on that particular sector?
We're looking at what can be done. What we are aware is that there is a big discrepancy between the costs for between various nursing homes, and we need to understand where there are savings that can be made that we can grab them. Because ultimately, Brian, we have to do two things. We have to keep investing in healthcare. We have to keep growing the number of beds, building the hospitals, building the primary care centres, hiring the healthcare workers. At the same time, public expenditure and reform quite rightly have challenged and said, if we're going to invest, we must be able to see more and more and more patients being treated for that investment. And if I could just finish on this and say, to be clear, the number of patients treated last year was the highest level it's ever been. It'll be higher again this year. And what this is about is saying, are there more ways we can treat more patients and drive the waiting list down faster?
All right. Before I let you go, Minister, I'd like to get your reaction to the comments, and it'll be carried in an RT investigation. Programme this evening. Barrister Marie O'Shea, who carried out the review of our abortion laws, it was published, I think, about this time last year. She made a number of recommendations, most of which have not been implemented. And she says one of the results of that is that women who seek terminations abroad because they miss various deadlines here are being treated as criminals. And says it's time that you acted on the recommendations that she brought forward, will you?
Well, first of all, most of the recommendations in the report are being implemented. The vast majority of recommendations in that report are operational recommendations. I brought the report to government last year. We set up a HSE working group on the back of that. And let me give you one example of the progress that's being made. At the start of this government's term, only 10 of the 19 maternity hospitals were providing termination services. That's gone from 10 to 17, and by the end of this year, it should be all 19. So it's important to say that our healthcare workers are doing an awful lot to progress these services. There are additional recommendations which may require legislative change. I got a report back from the Health Committee in December. Mm-hmm. That's something that's now being discussed at a governmental level. What I would say, so Brian...
Would that include, for example, the three-day wait, which according to her report, Ms. O'Shea's report, can extend to 4 or 5 days in some cases, if it includes a weekend, for example.
So the extension to 4 or 5 days is an operational issue. And if there are any legislative issues, that's a matter that government is looking at and ultimately government will decide on. On the three-day wait, I just say two quick things. The first is that when I knocked on doors, and when many of us knocked on doors campaigning for repeal, I had very detailed conversations mm-hmm. with voters in Wicklow and around the country, and they voted for repeal on the basis of what was in the heads of bill. Now, whether mm-hmm. I or anyone else agrees right. or disagrees,
but you also
that's
instituted a review process
on.
Which was designed to give an yeah. ongoing assessment of how the legislation was operating. For example, the 12-week cut-off limit, again, that's something she says needs to be looked at.
I think we have to apply common sense here. I'm not satisfied that we have women who are getting caught by a day or two on one side of that 12 weeks. I don't believe that's the intention of it.
That seems to be what's happening.
Which is exactly the point of the review and exactly why
so
we're looking
at all of these things. What action has been taken on that as a result of the review a year ago?
So the Joint Committee on Health has looked at it. They came back to me in December. It's now being looked at by government. In the meantime, there are operational changes that can be made. So in terms of people having to wait 4 or 5 days, for example, that's not a legislative issue. Right. That's an operational issue that's being looked at by the working group.
And the 12-week limit, is that something that could change within the term of this government?
I don't want to preempt what government says. My position on this is, we have to apply common sense. We have to do what is right by women. We have to do what is right by patients. On the three-day wait, as an example, the original implementation of that was a woman had to go and meet, physically see the GP twice. During COVID, we changed that to one visit and one phone call. We've now kept that as the permanent operating model. So there's already been a significant reduction in the onerous nature of that. And so government will look at both what the report says. Government will also be cognizant of what people voted for in the referendum. We have to balance those two things.
All right. Mr. Vahel, Stephen Donnelly, thanks very much for talking to us on the programme. Back with more after this short break.
No chopping, no peeling, no mashing, no dishwashing, no bother. Centra's selected range of freshly prepared meals are now only 2 for €8. Mix and match tasty curries, rich lasagnas and more classics. Made by our experts to make dinner easy. Shop smart, feel good at Centra. Offer available until May 1st.
Irish National Opera presents Verdi's classic love story, La Traviata. Featuring the Irish National Opera Orchestra and Chorus, La Traviata comes to the National Opera House Wexford, the Gaiety Theatre Dublin and Cork Opera House this May. Tickets from €15. Additional fees may apply. See irishnationalopera.ie. Funded by the Arts Council.
RTE Radio 1.
Paolo Nutini. Cormand Park, Limerick, on Saturday the 13th of July. His only Irish show in 2024. With very special guest, C-Mat. Tickets available now from Ticketmaster.ie. Subject to licence. Paolo Nutini, live at Cormand Park. Tickets available now.
Music updates on RTE Radio 1.
Hello again, you're listening to the news at 1. A court has heard the telecoms company Air employed a deliberate policy aimed at preventing customers from logging complaints. District Court Judge Anthony Halpin branded the company a disgrace and said it should apologise to its staff who were threatened with disciplinary action if they did not adhere to the policy. Air was today fined €7,500 after pleading guilty to 12 counts of breaching regulations governing how complaints should be handled by providers. Our court's report. Reporter Vivian Traynor was in court. Vivian, the case taken by Comreg, what did they say Air was doing wrong?
Well, Brian, it involves breaches of what's known as Universal Service Regulations and the Comreg Code of Practice, which has a statutory basis. These regulations and codes of practice set out the mechanism through which complaints should be resolved. It includes being able to make a complaint, for example, at the first point of contact or being told how to make a complaint, how complaints are recorded, the time frame under which they're dealt with, the procedure. For example, customers are supposed to be given a unique identifier and the complaint acknowledged within 2 days. The complaint should be resolved within 10 days, and if it's not resolved, customers should be given an email address. Now, Michelle O'Donnell from Comreg's compliance section told the district court today that it had received a number of complaints from Air customers alleging that they were simply unable to make a complaint, lodge a complaint, or that complaints were remaining unacknowledged or unresolved for several weeks and even months in some cases. So that's what led them to investigate Air.
There was mention of a training manual for staff with specific instructions.
Yeah, as part of that investigation, they discovered that there was a complaints management manual, and it included instructions for staff about how to deal with complaints. On one of the pages, outlined and underlined, outlined in a red box, it had said, "Under no circumstances are the complaints number or complaints web page address to be provided to any customer. An agent found to be doing this will be the subject of disciplinary procedures under call avoidance." Another part of that same manual suggested that complaints should only be progressed or passed on to the complaints line if a customer used certain trigger words or phrases. Now, these included, for example, if a customer said, "I want a reference for Comreg," or "I want to log a formal complaint," this might indicate then that this customer was aware of their rights or aware of the regulations. If they simply said something like, "I want to complain," "I want to talk to your manager," "I want to talk to a supervisor," that complaint would not be progressed in line with the regulations. And customers were sometimes offered a callback, which may or may not happen. Now, Judge Anthony Halpin said this was an aggravating factor. He said it was a disgrace that staff were threatened with disciplinary action for simply complying with Irish law.
And any response in court from Air, Vivian?
Yeah, counsel for Air, Hugh McDool, said he was instructed to apologise to customers, to the court and to Comreg for the failings. He was prompted by the judge to perhaps apologise to staff as well because of that manual. He said that since these breaches were identified, Air had taken immediate action to improve compliance. They had additional training, more staff put in place, and the complaints team now review the log on a daily basis. And he said that over the 2 years covered by the summonses before the court today, the company had received 4.6 million calls to customer care, and there had been a general downward trend of complaints since then. He had offered to make a charitable donation on behalf of the company, The judge said it wasn't a case in which he could allow that. He said this was a very serious case and he imposed fines of €750 on each of 10 counts to which the company had pleaded guilty. Now, Barbara Delaney from Comreg said this was an important case to highlight customer rights.
The main message is that you are entitled to lodge a complaint. You must get a complaint reference. You must get an acknowledgement within 2 days. You must get a response or an answer within 10 days. Know your rights. Comreg can help you know your rights through comreg.ie. If you know those, you can then, I suppose, make sure that those rights are upheld yourself. But you can still come to Comreg then if that's not happening. Obviously, we will be continuing to monitor this and hopefully Aircom and other service providers will ensure that this key fundamental right is put in place. Businesses in Ireland, electronic communications companies, cannot do business without actually allowing their customers to complain to them. That is a fundamental of doing business here. It's a right, and Comreg is very serious to make sure that that right is upheld.
Barbara Delaney of Comreg ending that report from Vivian Traynor. Concerns have been raised over the low number of rental properties available to those who are in receipt of the Housing Assistance Payment, or HAP. There were 38 properties within the HAP scheme available for rent last month, according to the latest Simon Communities Locked Out of the Market report. Sligo had the lowest number of any properties available, with just two across a three-day period in March. Mary Jemison is North West Manager with Focus Ireland.
We weren't surprised by that when we saw the report, because we have an advice and information service that anybody can use to have help around. Typically, people come in help around housing. They cannot find anywhere to rent that is either within HAP or affordable, and particularly in Sligo town. So we had 190 people between January and the end of March use that service. And that's about a 10% increase on the same time last year. So we're seeing people who are getting valid notice of terminations. They're looking and looking. Then they come to us because they can't find anywhere. They can't move out of the property that the landlord is selling. And it's very, very stressful for people when they're in that situation. And they come into us and we're looking on Daft. We're looking at myhome.ie. We're looking at shared houses, shared rooms in a house, all of that. And there's so little available for people. It's just extremely limited.
Now, have you noticed an increase in the number of terminations? Is that something that you think is increasing?
That certainly, we've noticed that over the past year. And I think it's just, it's individual landlords who might have inherited the family home, or, you know, might just be one property, but they either want their own family in the home or they're selling just to get out of rent it. So there's very little movement. People who are in private rented apartments are staying in them. There's not a huge amount of allocations with the local authority. So there's very little movement for people in private rented.
Sport on RTE Radio 1.
And it's very good afternoon to Gary Moore.
Good afternoon. And as you may have heard earlier in the programme, the Football Association of Ireland has announced that Chief Executive Jonathan Hill will leave his post at the end of this month after 3.5 years in the position, with an interim CEO to be appointed until a full-time successor is found. Hill was the first permanent CEO of the association following the governance issues which emerged during the lengthy tenure of John Delaney, but he was heavily criticised by members of the Public Accounts Committee in Leinster House in February following his explanation of payments to him that were relatively small, but against the FAI's own staff rulebook. On the positive front, he did oversee the introduction of an equal pay agreement for the women's national team, a successful joint bid to host the Euro 2028 finals, and of course next month's Europa League final will also be played at the Aviva Stadium. However, 145 days after not renewing the contract of men's senior manager Stephen Kenny, no replacement has been appointed. The BBC is reporting that Everton have lodged a formal appeal against their second points deduction for breaching the Premier League's financial rules.